Livewire with Jason Moyle.
Seven little girls sitting in the back seat, hugging and a kissing with Fred. I said, why don't one of you come up and sit beside me? And this is what the seven girls said.
All together now, one, two, three. Keep your mind on your drive and keep your hands on the wheel. Keep your snoopy eyes on the road ahead. We're having fun, sitting in the back seat, kissing and a hugging with Fred.
Drove through the town, drove through the country, showed them how a motor could go. I said, how do you like my triple carburetor? And one of them whispered low.
All together now, one, two, three. Keep your mind on your drive and keep your hands on the wheel. Keep your snoopy eyes on the road ahead. We're having fun, sitting in the back seat, kissing and a hugging with Fred.
Seven little girls smooching in the back seat, everyone in love with Fred. I said, you don't need me, I'll get off at my house. And this is what the seven girls said.
All together now, one, two, three. Keep your mind on the drive and keep your hands on the wheel. Keep your snoopy eyes on the road ahead. We're having fun, sitting in the back seat, kissing and a hugging with Fred.
All of them in love with Fred. Kissing and a hugging with Fred. Wish that I could be like Fred.
Hello, I'm Jason and welcome to Livewire. My guest on the show today is American hit recording artist, singer, songwriter and author Paul Evans.
Hello, Jason. Nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
That's okay. Now, you've got a book out and you've had over six decades in music. When did it all start for you? Obviously in the 50s. Tell us a bit more about how it started.
Oh, yeah, it started because New York at the time, and I lived in New York City, New York was the center of music, pop music in the world. Tin Pan Alley, the Brill Building, of course, is where everything started. Everybody in the Brill Building, we all knew that the right place to go, it was the place to go. Everybody that was there that you would know their names. You know, all Lieber and Stoller, everybody who wrote for the 50s and the 60s were at the Brill Building. So when I woke up one day and said, I want to be a professional singer and writer, there was only one place to go. And for me, that meant a bus ride and a subway ride into Manhattan, which we called the city, even though the people in the outer boroughs never liked when we called Manhattan the city, because they were part of the city too. I went into Manhattan and found the Brill Building, found it all by myself. I was scared out of my mind because this was the place with the names I knew. And that's how it started. I went in, I gave myself a year, Jason, which is ridiculous. I gave myself a year to have a hit record or I was gonna go back to college.
Okay.
A stupid prompt. You know, it's really stupid. You can't do that. But I got lucky in the first year. I had When, the Kalin Twins record. That was a big hit around the world. And then I had Seven Little Girls sitting in the back seat the next year as a singer. And I was out of the Brill Building for quite a while then because I was touring.
So obviously you're a songwriter and a singer. What gives you the most satisfaction, writing a really good song or being on stage performing?
Well, a tough one. It's always a tough question to answer. I think the answer though is being on the stage, that was really kind of cool. I mean, I ate up the applause. I love the applause. I love singing for the people. And you know, there's a funny thing about being on stage. Sometimes it's not happening. That's awful. It's just not happening. You don't feel the audience coming back at you. But when they do, it's really like a bolt of electricity. It's a wonderful feeling. You know, not only did I tour with my hit records, I eventually wound up singing with a jazz quintet, which was really weird for me to be invited into a jazz quintet. I've never studied jazz. I don't know anything about it. But I learned how to read music. So I knew how to read, and I worked hard at it, and I became a member of this jazz group called Group 5, and we traveled Scandinavia to all the jazz festivals, and we traveled in the States too. So I would think being on stage, but my second best honor and feel good thing is the book, honestly, because this is what a chance I had. The publisher asked me to write a book about my life. That's crazy, Jason. It was just crazy. And I love that he did it. And it was a real hard effort, and it was a work of love. I loved it.
But there must be so many stories in your life, not just as a songwriter. As I said, you've written loads of great songs for different artists, as well as obviously writing songs for hits yourself. So, and you must have loads of stories of the time in music.
Oh, I did. I had a wonderful time in music. I have a lot of anecdotes in the book because I can remember them. I mean, it's fabulous that this book has taken me back right through the early part of this 60-year career that I had in music. There was one that I know this one works. It's a funny story. It's about Al Byron, who was my co-writer. And on Roses Are Red, which was, of course, a smash hit by Bobby Vinton. And who had it here in your... Ronnie Carroll, that's right.
Yeah.
Ronnie had the big hit in England. But Al wrote that. He wrote my own song, Happy Go Lucky Me, which was where we took the name from my book.
Yeah.
And Al and I were sitting in this restaurant called the Turf Restaurant, Jason. Turf was for the writers because there was another restaurant that was for the publishers. It was a little more expensive. So we stuck with the Turf Restaurant. Anyway, I was sitting with Al, who looked exactly, Jason, exactly like Buddy Holly.
Oh.
Yeah, and especially then he bought the glasses, those big glasses that Buddy wore. Anyway, I'll make this quick. A little kid came up to us, and he had a pencil and paper in his hand, and he said, Mr. Holly, would you please give me an autograph? I love your music, and I like an autograph. And Al, who is an obstinate guy, said to this little kid, I am not Buddy Holly.
Uh-huh.
So the kid now starts to tear up. He said, I hate to bother you, sir, but Mr. Holly, sir, but I would really like your autograph. And I'm elbowing my co-writer, Al, on the side, and I said, give the kid the autograph. He thinks you're Buddy Holly. You'll make a hero out of Buddy Holly. No, Al wouldn't do it. He said to the kid again, hey, I'm not Buddy Holly. And the kid now is crying. And he runs back to his family table in the restaurant, and here comes his mother. And his mother comes up to Al and I, and she says, Mr. Holly, we don't mean to bother you, but, you know, we have all your records at home. My son is a big fan of yours. All we would like is an autograph. And, of course, Al did not give her the pleasure of the autograph. He says, I am not Buddy Holly. And she now starts screaming, and the restaurant's turned everybody's attention to us. And she says, Mr. Holly, I am never going to allow another one of your records in the house. We're throwing out every record you have. I'm not going to allow this. You cannot, you will lose all our records. And I'm telling all my friends not to buy your records. Al had done his best to kill the career of Buddy Holly.
Oh, that is just an amazing story from years gone by. But you've also written songs for like Elvis Presley as well. What for you makes a really good song, but as a songwriter?
I think as a pop songwriter, it has to be singable. It has to be memorable. It just has to be. And it must make some sense to an audience. I mean, they must love the lyrics, and they must be able to sing the melody. For my part, I wrote with a bunch of different people. It was never, I never had one fella that we could team up and be the team. I wrote a lot with a fellow named Paul Pons. I wrote a lot with Al Byron, a.k.a. Buddy Holly. And because I love the experience of writing with different writers. It was just a wonder. It was refreshing. Some writers come at a song in one direction. Other writers would come at a song in another direction. I wrote lyrics with them. I wrote melody, but usually it was my melody. And Roses Are Red, by the way, is an interesting story that because Al Byron, who, again, a.k.a. Roy Holly, came into a demo session that I was doing. I was making small records to show to people. And he said, Paul, I have a lyric I want to show you. So it was a joke, Jason, a pure joke. I said to the musicians, take five, guys. I am now going to write a big hit song. Everybody laughed. I laughed. Al put the lyric to Roses Are Red right in front of me on the piano. And I wrote the melody exactly, Jason, as you hear it on the Bobby Vinton and Ronnie Carroll records, which is proves a silly point. You never know. I mean, I've spent months on a song, and when it's finished, I think this is the greatest song ever written. And then nobody likes it. Nobody else likes it. And here I wrote a song, and literally in maybe 2.5 minutes, I worked on it again for months, couldn't do any better than the original thing, melody that I had put down on the piano, and it would become my biggest hit ever. And it was number one in America for 4 weeks. That's a pretty long stretch. And Ronnie's record got to number three in England. And at the same time, the Bobby Vinton record got to number 11 in England. So it was a big worldwide smash.
Yeah, and so going back to your hit record in 1959, Seven Little Girls, which was with the Curls, so you had a backing group as well in the early days.
Yes, that was originally a demo for two writers. I was trying to make a living waiting for a hit song, and I ran into Lee Pockris and Bob Hilliard, they both had good chops. They had some good track records for having hits. I did a demo for them. And they hired the two girls to be the Curls. Unfortunately, the record company wanted a teenage idol, which would be me. And they didn't want the girls. They didn't want a group. They wanted a solo singer. And so the girls were let go. And the Curls recorded for a label called Everest. And they made two records that just didn't happen. So I felt bad, but you know, we were at the whims of the record company owners. We really had, as a kid in 1958, 59, even 60, we had no control over what we did. What the boss of the record company said to do, we did. And when we would travel, we would have fun on the road. And then one day we would wake up, because all we wanted as kids was a hit record. And then we'd wake up one day and say, wait a minute, we're supposed to be getting paid for our sales. And so I sent my attorney into Carlton Records, guaranteed owner records of the record company, Joe Carlton. And my lawyer came back and said, Paul, you're due $40,000 that has not been paid you. And this was in 1960. It was worth doing today. I can't imagine what they would have owed me.
Yeah.
And that happened because we were kids. That's in the book, by the way. I don't know if you read that chapter, but there was a chapter about they really took advantage of the fact that their stars were kids who only wanted a hit record.
Yeah.
That's what they wanted in life.
Yeah, and so you obviously continued writing songs, but then in 1979, another big hit record, and I've got to be honest here, this is one of my favourite songs of all time. One of my favourite songs of the year. But it just has such a hook to it. And for actually quite a tragic song, really, when you listen to the lyrics.
Yeah. Well, we had a girl singer. We have from Nashville. But I must tell you one thing, Jason, about Hello, This is Joni.
Yeah.
That was 20 years, almost exactly 20 years from Seven Little Girls Sitting in the Back Seat. I was 20 years older. I was in my early 40s. And to have a hit record in my early 40s, 20 years, Jason, can you imagine the way I felt? It was sensational. I think that's one of my favorite records because I finally charted in England. most of my other hit records in the States had been covered in England, and I did not have the hits in England. It took me 20 years to get a hit in England.
And yeah, it got to number 6 in the charts, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
And yeah, so tell us a bit about the inspiration behind the song.
Well, I wrote it with Fred Tobias, who had written a few hit songs. We were partners on this one. And he came to me and we did what we usually did. What shall we write today? And we would hang out and we would talk for a while. And then out of nowhere comes this song. We had an idea. Let's write about a telephone answering machine. Let's write in the tradition of the death songs that we had. There were so many hits about it was a whole genre of music in the pop business. It was death songs. So we wrote Joni, but we just wrote it with two songwriters who came up with an idea. Let's write this song. That's how it came about. There was no real story behind it. Unfortunately, I'd love to tell you that there was a real story behind it, but there wasn't. It was just two songwriters. And I sent the record, the demo. We made a demo on it, of course. And I sent it down to Chet Atkins in Nashville, who said he'd be interested in cutting me on it. I was thrilled. This is one of my heroes. Chet Atkins was just one of my heroes, big, big time hero. But I hadn't known that he had gotten sick, was no longer in charge of the label. But Bradley, a man named Bradley, Owen Bradley, was another big producer for Decca Records in America. And Owen's son took over Chet Atkins' position, and he broke my heart when he said he didn't want Chet to cut the record with me. Luckily, I ran into a fellow named Jimmy Wisner, who had his own well-known chops. He was known in the jazz field. He was known in the pop field. He had produced many, many hit records, and he loved the song. So we ran down to Nashville, and we cut Joni. And it was a country hit. It was number one on all the major country stations in the United States, but it never got past the 40s on the national chart, except for England and Australia. The English-speaking world got it, but Americans didn't get it.
It was just so hooky, I think, and that was the song had such a hook on it. It was kind of, you couldn't get it out of your head, basically. So, it's a great song. So tell us about how people can get hold of the book, because obviously it's a labour of love for you. You said it's one of the best things you've done is write the book. So there's lots of great stuff in there. So how can people get hold of the book?
Well, they can certainly get hold of it in England. You know, it's out. It came out in July 29th. It's not out in America yet because it's an English publisher who wanted me to do this book. And so they can certainly get it on Amazon UK. And they can get it. Oh, it should be in any bookstore now in England for certain, in Australia, in any place. But in America, it's not. You can pre-order it in America, but you can't order it yet. Okay. So, yes, thank you for mentioning it. Sometimes I get so involved with these interviews that I forget to try to sell the book. So thanks, Jason.
That's okay. And did you know if it's on Kindle as well? I know that it's about hardback and it's available on Kindle, do you know?
You know, it's not yet, and I'm not sure what the requirements are. I am not. And I read Kindles too. So I can't tell you if it's Kindle or not yet, but it is not an expensive book. It's in American dollars, it's a little less than $20. So that's not a lot of money. And it's starting to get some sales. It'll take time for interviews with people like you, Jason. You know, it just takes time. You got to get the news out.
Yeah. Well, good luck with the book. And we're going to finish off this interview with playing that song from 1979. Would you like to introduce it, Paul?
Oh, yeah. This is Paul Evans' big hit in England, man. Here comes Hello. This is Joni.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Oh, no. Thank you, Jason.
Came over to my house last night. I'm leaving and I let it go alone. I felt so damn bad this morning, I reached right for the phone and called her right away to beg her to forgive. The phone rang once, the phone rang twice, and then I heard her say, not knowing if she'd forgive me was tearing me apart. I couldn't go on this way, I had to call again. The phone rang once, the phone rang twice, and then I heard her say, baby's called at last. Instead it was a friend who said that Joni's car had crashed. I never should have let her drive home angry from my place. I'd never hold her again and kiss that funny face. But still there was a way to hear her voice again. The phone rang once, the phone rang twice, then I heard her say,
LiveWire is produced by Steve Osborne Media. Steve Osborne Media.
Hello, I'm Jason, and new to the LiveWire office this week, we have got two new songs. One from Mike Lindup, who is a founder member of Level 42. We'll tell you a bit more about that in a minute. But first of all, we've got a brand new one from Steps, who are currently on a UK tour. And this is the fourth single taken from their album, What the Future Holds, Part 2. It's called 100 Years of Winter.
People give up, they never remain. They never stay together in love. They all run away. Somebody tore the heart from your chest and it left a stain. So wait.
Yeah.
Our second and final track on Livewire this week is from Mike Lindup. He is a founder member and keyboard player of Level 42, and this song is taken from his forthcoming album Changes 2, which is 30 years after his first solo album. And this single is called You Can't Just Live as an Island.
Because it's